Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. It's a great pleasure and honor for me to be here and to have this opportunity to give this talk. And in the beginning, I'd like to thank the organizers for their kind invitation. So I took this appointment rather seriously. So in the beginning, I thought I'd better search for some famous statements from famous people about the future of science, technology. And after a careful lookup, I ended up with a few syntagmas which I would like to share with you, just to convince you that giving any vision for the future is a bit tricky business. So I'd start with something from computer science. So here are some thoughts about the size, about the possibilities concerning computers, and also it tackles a little bit the issue of data science. So, data processing is a fad that won't last out the year. It's interesting and quite intriguing to see what we have thought about certain issues in science and technology not so long ago. And similar statements were available also for other technological improvements that we nowadays use extensively. For example, even Lord Kelvin thought that heavier-than-air flying machines are not possible. Obviously, if something happens, it must be possible, but this is just to illustrate the principle of how dangerous it is to give any vision without thinking it very, very thoroughly. And just one last example concerning automobiles and their developments. And I find especially the last thought very intriguing and motivating, and I'm going to use this argument throughout the lecture. You see, the ordinary horseless carriage was thought to be a luxury of the wealthy. And I think there is an analogy to this statement which somehow was present in the scientific literature not so long ago. But don't get me wrong, all these examples are, so to say, negative examples or examples where there is a certain degree of suspicion in the future of some technological or scientific advancement. As I said, don't get me wrong, I have no suspicions whatsoever in the future of EOSC or open science in Europe. On the contrary, I even think that no matter how immodest any vision may seem now, it could become truth not so far along the road before us. But yeah, this is just about to see that making any vision is not always easy, and it hasn't been easy before in science. So in my lecture, I'm going to make a sort of a revision how it all started, how the idea of open science in Europe originated, where are we now, and what is the future with certain modest predictions, I would say. Of course, if after my talk you don't get what this is all about, I will leave you with another expert in the field who, at least for me, has always an answer what it's all about. It's my favorite jazz guitar, Pat Metheny. So, it all started back by an initiative of the European Commission, which was aiming to develop a sort of an infrastructure for open science in Europe. And that initiative actually nowadays provides about 2 million not only researchers but also professionals in science and technology with different environments, although virtual environments, for and services for storage, management, analysis, and what is most important perhaps from the viewpoint of a scientist, reuse of research data, something that we need heavily these days. So this initiative, actually, if you look at Wikipedia nowadays, you will find this definition for the European Open Science Cloud. It is still regarded as an initiative. But this initiative has become an ambition, I would say nowadays, an ambition to provide not only the researchers, but also the innovators, companies, and citizens with something which will be, on one hand, multidisciplinary, where everyone can publish, find, and reuse certain data. But the focus is nowadays not only on data, but also tools, services, and as you will see in my last envisioning slides, the description of the methodological advancements and of the methodological procedures to do whatever is needed to be done in contemporary science and technology. So the idea is that such environment will operate under strictly defined conditions and also to enable trust and safeguard to the public interest. In these 2 days, it has been spoken to a great extent about what EOSC enables, but just a brief recapitulation in this context. It really enables a steep change across scientific communities towards seamless access, fair management, you all know what it means, quite good, and reliable reuse of research data and other digital objects. So, the ultimate goal of the European Open Science Cloud is the development of a web of fair data and services for science in Europe. And the aim towards open science in Europe is, in some countries nowadays, not an option. It's the only way forward towards further developments. And, of course, it affects open science practices to a great extent. As a final guidance towards the aims, we can say that the full deployment of the EOSC, about which I'm going to talk a bit further on, is meant to lead to higher productivity, but not just higher productivity. It should enable improved trust in science through reproducibility and reuse of data. But reuse means not only reinterpretation of certain data, but also a thorough check of the data and of the standard theories and approaches in different scientific areas. So now for this talk, I'm going to give two particular examples from my own research group with my collaborators, which I believe, of course, not going into too many technical details, will illustrate the benefits, the current benefits of the open science concept of the EOSC and especially the current NIFOS project. So, one of the issues that we are working on in my group nowadays are certain pharmaceutical crystals, of which clopidogrel hydrogen sulfate is a particular example, which is a very interesting system. It has two polymorphic modifications, which have very different mechanical properties, and it affects their processing in the pharmaceutical industry. That's why these are interesting. So we first focused on clarifying many issues. First of all, why two different crystal modifications have such different mechanical properties, but then going through the literature, we encountered certain thermal data about this system. This is a typical DS-seq curve, which shows for both of these polymorphic modifications, the endotherm peaks indicating the phase transition of melting. And this is what a typical figure in a scientific publication would look like.
So you see, main peak here, about 180 degrees centigrade. Don't look this way; it's not relevant to the current talk. But it seems that nothing significant is going on here. But we went on with our research by using temperature dependent Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy to get further insights into the structures of these compounds. And we have actually transformed our temperature dependent data by a particular technique called two-dimensional correlation spectroscopic analysis with a moving window. So what this technique enables us, it enables us to see along the perturbation coordinate, that's temperature in the current system, where the changes are most expressed. So we see that melting occurs at about 180 degrees centigrade. We see the onset of melting at about 160 degrees. But what we are seeing also is something that's going on quite below the melting temperature at 120 degrees and at 80 degrees. So one person who would be show suspicion in data science could say, okay, maybe it's an artifact of your simulation, of your methodology. Because if we go back to the figure, we would see that nothing significant happens here. But if we have the data, as we did in our case, we could reanalyze them, we could extend the scale and see that exactly two endotherm peaks with lower intensities appear at exactly the temperatures that we find with our moving window two-dimensional correlation analysis, and even with some more sophisticated techniques. So this is a very good example of reusing of data, how reuse of data can help us interpret the results and the particular applicable set of properties for a pharmaceutical crystal. So we were able further on to identify that these endotherms do not refer to a particular polymorphic transition or something that big, but rather to a very subtle rearrangement of the hydrogen bond structure in these compounds. The hydrogen bonding network is a very tricky network in this particular compound, so we had to use relatively high levels of theory of quantum chemistry at the level of finite cluster representation of our crystals to provide a very thorough analysis of the spectroscopic data. And Dejan talked about this in his presentation this morning. Moreover, since we want to go further, go beyond the finite cluster representation of our crystals, we want to do periodic DFT calculations for our system and see how the hydrogen bonding networks would respond to temperature perturbations. So that's why we want to apply density functional tight binding approximation of DFT. So for crystals like this, in which we have very strong hydrogen bonding interactions, there is a conceptual problem with DFTB concerning the repulsive potential. Not going into many details here, there is a way to circumvent the problem. There is a way to modify the parameters that we usually use in DFTB, and the particular methodology has been implemented in NIFOS. And the current implementation was with the Gaussian API, Dejan talked about it this morning too, which has been ported as a service of NIFOS. So if we do benchmarking of the DFT and DFTB data, then using the Gaussian process regression methodology with the service provided by NIFOS, we could correct our data and even directly have the improved Slater-Costner files with our parameters for further DFTB simulation. So In this simple example of a single system, we have shown that both reuse of data, which have been stored somewhere in the context of open science, and usage of the services developed in this manner too, can benefit our studies to a great extent. So another example, also from personal experience, concerns something that we work on currently with Blagoj, who also talked about this morning. It's the need for a more thorough interpretation of the infrared multiphoton dissociation spectral data, which have been collected by a rather famous group of Professor Thomas Rizzo in Switzerland. So interpretation of any spectroscopic data can be straightforward if you don't care about the details. And there are many publications nowadays in the literature where people straightforwardly implement the double harmonic approximation. They implement DFT methodology without caring out very much about the properties of the functionals that are used. And they get good agreement with their experimental data solely as a result of the cancellation of errors. If you do everything properly, in the course of interpretation of your experimental data, nothing worse works as it should. For example, it has been known for some time that if you skip the harmonic approximation, if you work with the unharmonic oscillators, the current DFT functionals, which are widely used, give crap results, literally, because they have certain deficiencies which are known. And that's why we thought that we ought to provide an alternative description of what happens in this experimental setup. The particular systems that we considered were protonated glycine and betaine as a fully methylated glycine, because for those two systems we had an extensive set of experimental data. What we did was to generate the as accurate as possible unharmonic trajectories of the oscillator, then computed the vibrational potential energy curves and solved the stationary Schrödinger equation using the Schrödinger API that has been developed and ported in the course of NIFAS project. There are, of course, other methodologies to do that, but the Schrödinger API is a very efficient and easy to use platform, especially when one begins his career in this area. And thanks to this approach, we have clarified a few things concerning interpretation of this data. First of all, we got very good agreement between theory and experiment. You see the best estimate. While we have shown that the standard functionals give results which are quite far away from what is experimentally observed. And practically, this gives us a vision that usage of such non-standard tools, which cannot be used automatically in the standard computer codes, can be further direction in computational quantum chemistry. So let's go back to the open science concept and how it affects our work nowadays. I remember my first experience and my first pain with the open science was the scientific articles. I still remember the time when I would get the contents direct from Elsevier, for example, or ASAP alerts from American Chemical Society, and then wrote directly to the authors and wait for them to send me their papers. Now, we can share the scientific papers through both NIFOS and EOSC. And in the Nordic countries especially, this is, as I said, a must. It's not anymore an option, but everyone tends towards this. Then computational tools, codes, data to reuse, and perhaps for me the most important thing for the advancement of science is the details of computational procedures. The recipes the detailed recipes how to do something. Because when you read a scientific paper, which has been written in a quite technical manner, it sometimes takes a lot of time to simply decipher it. When you have a tool, a service that performs a certain computation, and when you have the recipe, the details of the procedure, it can be double-checked, and it can be understood by those who are aimed to further develop the approaches. And just a few data given by the scientific publishers, by John Wiley and Sons, in this context, how open research appears to be the key to research communication. And according to John Wiley, open access, open data, and open practices, which is just another way of saying that the computational and all other procedures should be open, how these three pillars affect the further developments of science. According to the data by this publisher, on average, open access articles are downloaded more than 3 times as subscription ones. So it's quite high a number. Then the citations. It seems that the open access articles are cited about 50% more compared to subscription articles. And concerning the Altmetric score, which seems to be a nice alternative to the H index and all other numerical parameters aiming to judge about the quality of scientific work, receive nearly 3 times as much altmetric attention as the other one. So we can say freely that the vision of EOSC has turned into a mission. That's where we are now. And the vision started with the initiative that I mentioned in the beginning, and today EOSC is fulfilling its promise. And in the interest of time, I'm going to skip just 1 or 2 slides and go to my final slides. Don't forget that EOSC is a work in progress. And I think that the greatest vision is that in order for it to be beneficial for researchers, researchers have to contribute to it. And the development of EOSC depends directly on their direct contribution with software, data, services, tools, courses, and all other means. So, in the nearest future, what we should work on, in my opinion, connection and integration of the infrastructures developed within EOSC. Then extend the value chain of EOSC with a huge number of scientific use cases. Then innovation and growth of EOSC with services. Improved and enhanced training of the users and provided. And perhaps the most important thing that would, by a feedback mechanism, affect all the others, engage wider EOSC community at a global level. So that's all from me. Sorry if I went a bit above my time. Thank you for your attention.